This is episode 129 of The Variety Artist. This is John Abrams, your host and that guy that interviews successful variety artists from around the world every single week. As many of you know, I'm a family entertainer. I make my living performing at libraries and schools. I raised my kids with that money, sent both of them to private schools, sent one to college, lived in a beautiful neighborhood, and live a pretty darn good life. And even though I didn't know it, I owe most of that to my guest today. In 1999, I entered the library market. I performed about 100 shows every summer for the past 15 years or so, about 70 or 80 at libraries each year. I've met some of my best friends and favorite people at library showcases. My guest today is Jim Kleefeld. Jim basically created the library market. You're going to hear how and why he did it and why he's so good at it. You're going to hear about why he started performing at schools and how he became so good at it. You're going to hear how and why he put together books that are now considered the Bible for family entertainers. All I have to say is thanks, Jim Kleefeld. From me and all the variety artists that raised their families and improved their lives from performing at libraries. I guess there's nothing else to say, but on with the show.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
Jim is known for his exceptional school assemblies and extraordinary library programs. He's written many school and system curricula and co-authored two prominent social skills textbooks. Jim was the first to market themed library shows and is truly the expert in that field. Variety artist, I give you Jim Kleefeld.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
How's it going, Jim?
It's great, except for the fact that I'm not going. I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying home.
It seems like it, huh? Since this COVID thing.
Yeah.
Because you're in my field. You do libraries and schools just like I do, and all of them canceled on March 10th or 11th.
Yeah, they just started dropping quickly and then fell like dominoes one after another. All of a sudden, my summer was gone. And then about the 1st of August, I started getting all of my October and Halloween shows canceled. And then actually the two Christmas shows that I had booked before June called to cancel both of those. So I didn't even get a chance to market Halloween or Christmas very much since this just came on in last March.
Ironically, my last show to cancel was in a city named Corona.
Oh, wow. That's weird.
It's not far from me. It kept holding on and holding on. And I was thinking, oh, wouldn't that be ironic if that one held on that I did a show in Corona?
Well, I did a show in June, but I did keep a date for a June show. I think it was the 4th or 5th. Mm. It was in a small rural town in Ohio, not a big city. They had zero cases of coronavirus in the county. Mm. It was a big old library that had a large grassy front lawn. So they invited the parents to come, bring a blanket, sit their kids on the front lawn. Everybody spaced out 10 or 15 feet apart. The whole thing was outdoors. I was 20 feet away from the closest person watching. We think everything went okay there. That was about the last brave soul that wanted to venture into it.
Yeah, there are a number of people here in Southern California that are advertising and doing a lot of social distancing shows where they're doing exactly what you're talking about. They're 20 feet from the kids and the kids are 6 feet apart and everybody's spaced out, not spaced out as in their mind, I mean spaced out as in on the grass.
I talked to Robert Baxt, who's out there. You probably know Robert. He's doing social distancing shows, and he's got a telescoping pole with a bucket on it that he fish poles out toward the porch or wherever he's at, so somebody can take a card out of the things. And he told me that what a great idea that was, and I said, no, it's not a great idea. Ditch the take a card trick altogether, and just don't do that.
He's very successful he's always been very successful, but he's pivoted, pardon the expression, pivoted. We hear that all the time. He's pivoted his show, stayed successful throughout this COVID thing. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about before COVID. Tell us a little about your educational background? Because some of the people don't know of all of your educational background.
I did okay in high school. I was actually doing magic shows in high school. I started getting paid shows when I was about 14. A friend and I both got together and put on a magic show at the high school talent show. We did not win. Mm-hmm. I love performing. I love doing it way back then. I graduated. I went to college and I went into theater. I became a theater major. I learned acting and directing and set design and lighting design and picked up a really good education at a local regional theater. I don't know how many people know this, but Cleveland is actually the largest theater district in the country outside of New York City. There are more theaters and more people who go to the live theater in Cleveland than any other major metropolitan, including Detroit, Chicago, and LA. It's a very big theater town. I thought to myself, well, the most interest I have is really in set design. The art and the graphics and building the sets really appealed to me. I liked acting. I liked being on stage. I still did magic, but I wanted to be a designer. And I looked around and I thought, there's one big theater company in Cleveland and they have a set designer. I'd have to move. So I didn't want to go to New York and be an unsuccessful set designer.
Like the thousands of others, yeah, I imagine.
Right. So instead of moving to New York, I enrolled in graduate school and went for a degree in teaching. I got a master's degree in early childhood education, which included classes in child psychology.
Ah, now it's coming together.
Loved kids. I always liked being around kids. I liked doing the magic. Even when I was 15, I liked entertaining 5 and 6 year olds. You know, it's cool. Little kids just have enthusiasm for stuff like that.
Yeah, they love it.
I picked up a job teaching for Cleveland Public Schools right when I got out of college and worked on my master's degree and finished that child psychology degree. So that I could be a good teacher, which I loved doing. I taught kindergarten for the Cleveland Public School System for 30 years.
Wow.
Well, actually, I didn't teach kindergarten the first couple of years because that was 1971 when I started, and they told me men don't teach kindergarten.
Oh.
There's nothing to kindergarten except wiping noses and on boots. So I fought, and it took me a couple of in the nose and who you knows to get into a kindergarten program. I finally did get to teach five-year-olds and stayed there the rest of my career. I just absolutely love that age level. Kindergarten is their first shot at school, the first shot of being away from home for a lot of kids. At least it was back then. Nowadays, five-year-olds have already been in school for 4 years in many cases.
Yeah, with that two-parent working household.
Yeah, knowing the psychology behind kids and how they work and grow and how their mind develops really helped me to be a better magician, a kid show magician.
Well, did you start doing libraries while you were teaching?
I did. That's the nice thing about teaching. They only keep you in your job for 9 months and then they let you free for 3 months. So I had a 9 month job and a 12 month mortgage bill. So
yeah,
I figured I needed to do something in June, July, and August. And I figured magic shows was as good as anything. And I did the usual fair, blue and gold banquets in February and Cub Scout dinners and a birthday party here and there and club dates. Things like the Rotary and the Lions and a couple of block parties and festivals. But what hit me was that in order to specialize in birthday parties, you had to work Saturday and Sunday almost exclusively. Yeah. That's a weekend business. And I had two young boys. My wife was a worker in the hospital. She was a lab technician and she worked weekends. So I stayed home weekends with the two boys and I couldn't do birthday party. So never went after the market. I never, you know, I'd get a call once in a while, but I never went after that. So instead, I had all summer, especially, you know, during the daytime, and somebody called me from a library. she said, we saw you at such and such a banquet or a picnic or something, and we're mm-hmm. having a club, and the kids are going to read books, and at the end we want a party. Could you do a magic show for our party for our readers at the end of summer? Now, this was in 1971. Wow. There really weren't summer reading clubs or programs or themes at most libraries. But I did a magic show. It occurred to me, if this library wanted to entice kids to come in and read and have a magic show to reward them, maybe a lot of other libraries did too. Mm. So the next year I sent out flyers. I made up little brochures by hand. I sent those out, and I think I got 6 shows the next year. Nice. And I was surprised at how successful that was. That doesn't sound like a lot now, but for the fact that there really was no market back then. And I immediately glommed on to the aspect that if I was going to go back and do these same libraries every year, I better change my show.
Yeah.
So the next year, I put a theme show together. Every year after that, I changed the theme. Now, again, this is back when libraries started to have summer reading clubs, but didn't really have themes.
Yeah, I was about to say, because it's very different now. Now the library has a theme, and we try to match our theme with whatever they're doing.
Right. But my idea was, this is a different show than last year, and you know it's different because it's got a title and a theme to it. So mm-hmm. I did a jungle safari magic show, and the next year I did a cooking and baking magic show. And then I did a in 1976 I did a red, white, and blue All-American birthday bicentennial surprise magic show for summers. Mm-hmm. And having those themes got me to go back into the same libraries every year. They'd have me back again. After 6 or 7 years, I decided to expand my month. I was traveling 25, 40 minutes at to a handful, dozen or two libraries I could get to from here. And then I got a mailing list for every library in the state of Ohio. There are about 650 of them. And mm-hmm. I started mailing to the entire state. This was 6 or 7 years after I started. So maybe around 1980 or so.
So at that point in time, is anybody else seeing what you're doing and jumping into the new library market?
I didn't see anybody else for a handful of years. And then once in a while, other people show up. I'd run across Mark Wade, a good friend of mine who's a ventriloquist, lived in Columbus. We talked. He was doing a lot of fairs and festivals. He'd open a country fair for Reba McEntire or something. But, you know, there's a hollow spot there where you're not doing shows. If you're doing festivals, it's the beginning or the end of summer. If you're doing birthday parties, it's in the winter. So Mark Wade and I talked about it. He started doing them. Then we came across a few other people that were doing them. Usually there was a handful of sort of, I don't know, what I call local talent, sort of part-time mm-hmm. amateurs who wanted to do something, you know, a lady who played the guitar well and decided to do a little musical program. Those kinds of things cropped up. Most of them came and went. Somebody did it for 4 or 5 years, decided it was a lot of work and quit. I just hung in there. I just went after it every year and just kept doing it. And then pretty soon the libraries themselves started having themes, and I started doing what the libraries were doing. And then they came up with this multi-state consortium where lots of states had the same theme. That made it even a little easier. And by this time, 80s, 90s, there were a lot of other people sort of getting into the market. And it kind of grew and expanded from there. The libraries that had been doing it for 10 years were recording good numbers. Libraries run on numbers. That's, you know, they do statistics up the wazoo. How many people came through the door? How many books got checked out? How many films were watched? How many people attended a meeting? That's all they do, is keep track of those numbers.
Yeah, it's really important that you say that and that people listen to that too, because a lot of people ask me, I do a ton of libraries during the summer, although not this recent summer because of COVID, but I do a lot of libraries and people say, well, what is the secret? Is there a secret theme or something? Should I do a reading show? Should I do? And well, the answer is maybe yes to a reading show, yes to a book show. But the real key I have found is exactly what you're saying. Increase their numbers. Have a show that people will come to see, to check out books and check out movies and whatever the library is offering at the time. That's the key.
Right. Part of that is your advertising, your publicity. I've been an artist and a graphic designer for many, many years, and I work hard to make something that looks enticing. The less the libraries have to work, the more you can do for them, the better off you are. When I make a flyer or a brochure, I shoot for Madison Avenue. I try to make it look intriguing and colorful and attractive. They're just going to take whatever you give them and put it on their copy machine and then tape the poster to the front door. Right. If you send them garbage, everybody that comes in is going to see that garbage.
Right. And they're not going to get a lot of people in their library because they're looking at the garbage. Yeah.
You want something that looks good and professional and enticing. This will draw kids in, kid appeal. You want the kids to say, mom, I want to go to that.
Other than the posters and such, do you have kind of a step-by-step process, any kind of process when you're creating a new show?
I do, yeah. I do have a process for putting a show together. One of the things that I look for is repeat business, and that's sort of always in my mind. I want people to say, hey, that's the guy we saw last year. He was really good. He was really funny. Can I go back? I've had mothers come up and tell me, this is the 11th year in a row we have been to see your program at this library. You know, they're coming back to see me. They're coming in the library and the library's counting their numbers. But I put my name out there and I put my artwork up and I changed the show. But I try to make the show very appealing to the kids that are going to be there, the age level kids. One of the things that I do is come up with original plots and original art to use for the show. I don't want the kids to come in and say, oh, there's a magician and he's got that same coloring book that other guy had.
I laugh at that because we do showcases. I'm sure you're familiar with showcases. Yeah. And people that aren't, a showcase is where you go and perform for 5-7 minutes, whatever the showcase says, in front of a bunch of librarians. And it never fails. Almost every single year, someone has the magic coloring book, something the librarians have seen, I don't know, hundreds of times.
And they can't see it, but those librarians are out there in the audience rolling their eyes.
Yeah, you got to come up with something original. Those are the people that get hired. Even though the library patrons, the kids change over the years. For example, you mentioned that you started off with 5 or 6 different theme shows. If a kid is 5 years old and they see it for the first time, after 5 of them, they're now 10 years old, 11 years old, 12 years old. They'll graduate out of that. They won't go to the library after that, from my experience.
Right. There is some of that, but there's also a little overlap because that 10-year-old might have a 6-year-old brother who wants to go. Mm. So he might just keep going to your show when he's 11 or 12, only because mom only has one car and so many hands and so much time. Particularly, you get a larger family. You get, you know, a boy that's 12 and a girl that's 9 and another boy that's 7 and another girl that's 5. She's going to take them all somewhere.
And that 12-year-old too, he loves your show. He just doesn't want to admit it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So any other processes that you go through other than repeat business, costumes?
I do look for something that can be an outfit. If it's a theme show of some kind, I want to try to wear something. Now, I know a guy that that did library shows the year before last, I think was Outer Space. And he wore a NASA Walk on the Moon spacesuit. I mean, full tilt, bubble head helmet and white cloth with silver straps and big gloves and everything. I won't go that far because it looks cool, but it's hot and it's tiring. It's a lot of work. And I can't do 4 shows. If I got to take that off and put that on for every show in one day, you know?
Wait, are you telling the story about me? Because in 2001, it was something about a space theme or space odyssey theme, something like that. And I did exactly what you're talking about. And I didn't think about, I'm in Southern California. Summers in Southern California are anywhere between 75 degrees and 110. And I regretted it every step of the way. I booked a lot of shows.
Yeah, but... well, that's the thing. You will. There's a guy in Ohio that's a full tilt, full on pirate. I mean, we're talking Johnny Depp from the hat to the boots. Mm-hmm. And he gets booked, but he only has one act and one gig. He is the pirate. He loves it. It's a good act, but they won't hire him every year. They'll only hire him every 4 or 5 years because he does the same thing. And I do, as part of you, you know, you ask what kind of formula I have. One of the things that's sort of a formula that the librarians don't know is that it has to be fairly light and fairly easy. That's something I'm looking for. I do 100 shows in the summer.
Yeah, me too.
That's only generally 4 days a week because they don't usually want a show on Monday, sometimes, but not always. Usually they don't want them on Friday, sometimes, but not always. Nobody wants them on Saturday or Sunday. So I will get 3 or 4 shows on a lot of days. And I have to be able to get to a library, set up, wear my outfit, pack up and leave and get to another show 4 times in the same day. Yeah. So that's draining. I don't book a lot of shows that have 4 days, but I do book a lot of shows that have two, or a lot of days that have 2 shows and a lot of days that have 3 shows and some that have 4 shows. I'm not putting on, 20 minutes in the restroom with a costume thing.
Right.
I got to drive from one place to another. I got to stop and eat lunch somewhere along the way. So if nothing else, you know, a good, nice vest with a pattern on it and a hat of some kind, a safari jungle hat with a quick jacket, with a lot of pockets you can throw over a t-shirt, something that you can put on and take off. To me, it says, oh, look at that guy dressed up. Not, like he just showed up.
All right, well, let's switch gears a little bit. Let's talk about school programs. So you're doing tons of libraries.
Right.
Now, how did the school thing come about?
Well, I was a teacher. I went to programs and took my kids and we sat in the auditorium and we watched programs. And the school I was in had 3 or 4 every year. They had African dance troupes. They had a health, how to brush your teeth assembly. They had a guy who just brought in animals, held them up, told you, this is an anteater. And left. There were lots of programs, including a few magicians, and the magicians were awful. Every one of them I saw, and I worked in the school system for 30 years. I think I saw 10 different magicians come and go, and every one of them was a bad show. My kids wanted to leave. My class said, is it over yet? Can we go?
And oh, no.
The magic wasn't bad. The show was bad. You'd have a guy who'd come out with a ruffled shirt and a tuxedo and a Las Vegas attitude and glitter everywhere. And he'd do balloons and dove productions. And in any nightclub or ordinary venue, that might have been a decent show. But he did that for 15 minutes. And then he'd sit on the edge of the stage with the microphone and say, no, I want to talk about self-esteem. When I was young, I didn't have any self-esteem. And then I figured out that I needed to get self-esteem. And if you have self-esteem, you'll be, he'd do that for 40 minutes. That was the rest of his show. Most of the magic acts were awful. So after doing full-time libraries, 60, 70, 80 shows every summer, and then going back to school, and that I decided when I retired from teaching, I would do school assemblies that were good programs. So I retired in 2000 with a 30-year career in teaching. I was still putting together a summer library show every year. Now, this was 20 years ago in 2000. And I decided to go into the school assembly market. And I built shows from the ground up to be educationally sound, I started with the theme. The first one I did was reading motivation. What will get kids interested in books and know about books? That was easy because I'd been doing libraries and it included books and talk about books. The next one I did was about character. And I really studied what are the 6 points of character? What do teachers want kids to know about character? What is fairness and trustworthiness and honesty? What kinds of things makes a good person? And then I looked for tricks that fit the topic or the theme. You know, what is respect and how can you show respect with a magic trick?
Real quick, let's go back to that just a teeny bit, because the important thing that I heard, and this is something I do, and I think the better entertainers do, is you pick the education first.
Right.
And figure out all the education first, and then you match the magic trick or the balloon trick or whatever it is that you're doing secondly.
Right. Schools, at least nowadays, do not pay for entertainment. You cannot go in and just be fun. They don't have time to do that. They have to account for what's going on in the school every minute of the day. If you come in and say, I'm a magician, this is a fun show, we're going to have a blast, you're out the door. They won't even hire you. They're not going to pay for that. They're not going to waste their kids' time having fun. But if you say, I can teach your kids all about anti-bullying. I can explain to them what a bully is and what bullying behavior looks like. I can teach them ways to stop being bullied and give them some help in how to not bully others. Now you've got an educational program. You put the magic into that in a way that makes it fun and exciting and interesting, but you start with the core concept.
And the core concept sells the show to the principal, the teachers, the PTA.
And those change. They're cyclical. Schools wanted anti-drug stuff for a while, and then they didn't. They got tired of it, and they said, well, we've done that to death, which is a little sad because they have done it a lot. They did it for years, but they have new fifth graders this year and new fourth graders this year. They have people that didn't get anti-drug stuff done to death. But the teachers get tired of it, so now they're into ecology. They'll save the earth, styrofoam cups, throw out your trash, recycle. And they did that for 10 years. And I'm like, yeah, well, okay, everybody knows all about that. We've done that. Now let's do something else. So then they get into anti-bullying, and then they get into cyber stalking. It seems like every 3 or 4 years, there's a kind of new hot button topic. So you have to kind of keep up with that. You have to watch the schools, look at the bulletin boards, see what's in the newspapers, what are people talking about, what are teachers and principals interested in fulfilling for their market.
Right. And right now it seems like STEM or STEAM seems to be the big buzzword, right?
Yeah, that's probably the biggest one at this point, but I think it's on the downside. I wouldn't spend 2 years putting together a STEM show right now because it might be fading out by the time you get to market it.
What do you think the future holds then as far as themes go for schools? Do you have any idea?
I think a lot of them are cyclical. Actually, ecology was real big 10 or 15 years ago and then almost faded out completely. And now it's sort of popping back around. You know, there's some new buzzwords, you know, global warming is part of that aspect of ecology, taking care of our earth. It's not the same as reduce, reuse, and recycle, but it's, you know, it's part of a larger curriculum they're looking at. I don't know, the next wave might be healthcare. It might be something to do with what do you do in a post-COVID world? I'm not really sure.
So I was just watching the debates. We're taping this before before November 3rd, October 27th.
I'm assuming you're using that definition loosely.
Yeah, especially that first one.
Not so much debate as argument, I think.
Yeah, exactly. But the interesting thing about that is that the main topics of the debate seem to transfer to schools in the future. Like the big topics were COVID, of course, what you're talking about, global warming, and those types of things. And it seems like those might filter into schools into the future.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. there's another one coming up, which is a sort of a, I don't know what you would call it exactly, but there's a lot of talk about downsizing. I guess it's maybe sort of anti-materialism. Don't just spend your life running around spending money and collecting stuff and filling your big house with tons of stuff you don't need. You know, people are buying tiny houses. They're simplifying their life. They're reusing what they have and not spending their whole life trying to get more and bigger stuff.
Yeah.
I'm 71 years old and my house is full. I'm telling you, full of stuff, mostly magic, a lot of books. But my two sons who are in their 40s, their houses are Spartan. They look at something and they like it and then they give it away. They don't keep stuff. They don't store stuff. They don't want stuff.
Yeah.
That's sort of a part of the, you know, that ecology trend is, it's wasteful to buy tons and tons of things, use them a little bit, store them for years, and then throw them out or drop them off at Goodwill or something.
Well, what do you think about back of the room sales for schools and or libraries?
I don't do them. I've never done them. Well, that's not true. Not never. In my adult shows, I offer a book that is basically a rehash of the hour-long lecture I just gave. It's basically a printed version of what I told them when I did the program. It is a printed paperback staple, saddle-stitched book that I wrote, mostly from my script. And I do offer those at adult programs. That's the only back-of-the-room sales I've ever done. I am not fond of trying to sell stuff to libraries because of a couple of reasons. First of all, they go to the library because everything's free. The books are free. Yeah. The DVDs are free. You take them out, you bring them back. Partly because of that, kids don't come with money. So they have to go beg mom for money. It's just a personal philosophy thing. I know guys that make a lot of money on back of room sales. Maybe I could be richer and I could have more stuff in my house if I'd done that.
Yeah, you get more stuff.
I just never kind of got into it. I don't have much to say about it because I never really, you know, I know there are guys who do it and your guys do it well. To me, I want to be known as the really cool, funny entertainer we came to see, not the guy who did a nice job and then sold us this thing that we lost or that broke.
Yeah, though you do have a number of books on the market, right? Tell me about your book, Kids Show Matters.
Michael Close, a good friend of mine who took over MUM Magazine, called me and said, could I write a column for the magazine? And I did a 500-750-word column every month on a different topic about kid shows. I decided that I would start with a topic and then develop a trick to go along as sort of to teach that topic in the same way I built educational school assembly programs. Here's something you need to do as an entertainer. And each month the topic was something about being a good entertainer. One time I talked about look, don't see, what it is and why it works. One time I talked about not embarrassing your volunteers and how to handle children with respect. One time I talked about redesigning old props. So if you have a prop, you don't just bring the same thing that the last guy brought. You've colored it, painted it, pasted a label on it or something so it looks different. I put all of those together once a month over 3 years. And when I got all done, Mike called me and said, Jim, I think you need to make this into a book. This is a marvelous collection of ideas. So I put all of the columns, 36 topics about being a kid show entertainer, each one with an example of a magic trick you can make, build, or a routine with three ropes or something. And I rewrote a lot of it so that it would sort of feel more like a book format instead of, oh, he just took these out of his magazine column. I think it makes a virtual encyclopedia of how to be a kid show performer. There's magic in it, but mostly, you know, there's just some very, very good topics. Let me give you a tip right off the bat here is the very first chapter in the book is called Every Audience Counts. And that's something that I haven't seen all performers do. They go out and they, and I've heard them, I've talked to them. They said, well, I was a little late, but it's okay. It was just Cub Scouts. They're, and I'm like, I've never said it's just so-and-so. Yeah. Every show counts. The parents watching, the kids watching, and it doesn't matter if they're older kids than you thought, if they're younger than you thought, if it's a birthday party for a two-year-old and none of the cousins came, you still have to nail it. You have to entertain them to your best ability. You have to make it funny. You know, you don't short them on the humor. You don't make fun of the crowd size or the conditions. If it's, you know, a poor neighborhood, no matter what it is, that's an audience. And somebody in there is watching you, hoping to have a good time. And you don't know who's watching you. It might be the chairman of IBM or, who knows, the principal of the local elementary school. A lady in the back might be the owner of 6 daycares. Every audience is your potential to have more audiences, more shows, more gigs. So you treat the audience with respect and you make sure that everybody there knows you gave it your all. You give it 100% every time.
Yeah, here's a quick little story about that. I did a birthday party years and years ago, and one of the people in the audience, which I didn't know he was there, I didn't know he was going to be there, but he was an anchor for the Channel 5 News in the morning. Do they have anchors in the morning? I don't know. He was on the Channel 5 News in the morning, and he talked about the birthday party and talked about the magician that was there. Now, I didn't know if he was there. If I would have shorted that birthday party, it would have been a horrible experience, and he may have said something on Channel 5 News in the morning about it.
Yeah, exactly. That's a perfect example.
Well, tell us how you have 10 more, 10 or so more books, right?
Yeah, because of the themes for libraries changing every year, I decided back in 2011 to write a book to teach people what tricks you could do for the theme that year. That year, the theme was bugs and insects. So I wrote a book with 15 or 20 tricks you could do about bugs. There was a vanishing spider and a color Monty kind of thing where the insects disappeared. And there was a how to produce a jar of honey out of a hive. There was a trick with an ant farm in that book. You remember Uncle Milton's little the plastic thing where you put the ants in the top and they dig tunnels?
I had one.
The actual ant farm?
Yeah, I actually had the flat plastic. It wasn't, it was kind of flat and it had sand inside and you can see them. Yeah.
Well, I designed a trick where you show that and it's all filled in, just regular sand. And then somebody picks a name out of the hat, and then you turn the thing around and the ants have dug tunnels that spell out that name.
Oh, that's great.
That's a cool trick. Anyway,
that's very cool.
Yeah. Back in 2011, I wrote that bug magic book and everybody who bought one loved it. So every year after that, I wrote another book about the theme. So when the theme was going to be outer space, I wrote an outer space magic book. When the theme was going to be about digging and dirt, I wrote Dig Into Magic. The one year the theme was water. One year the theme was world cultures. I've written 10 library show theme books, and they're just chock full of all kinds of routines and tricks you can do with stuff you already have, like dig out your pizza box or your stratospheres and do this with it, and also stuff you can make. I put a lot of artwork in there. You can print on your home printer and glue stuff together and make your own tricks. So I put those 10 books together, one every year. The last one for this past year was Fantasy Magic, which a lot of people bought and never got to use because all their fantasy-themed shows for this summer were canceled.
Right.
And then I made two more, one that's all Halloween tricks and one that's all Christmas and winter holiday tricks, too. So
that's a great resource, because I don't know if people know this or not, but libraries also repeat their themes.
Yes.
Over the years.
Yes.
So they'll do dinosaurs, for example, one year, and then 7 years later, they'll say, haven't done dinosaurs for a while, so we'll do dinosaurs.
Exactly. In fact, next summer coming up, I don't think California and Texas follow the same theme as most every other state does. For a lot of the states coming up next summer, it's Tales and Tales. spelled with an AI and spelled with an ALE. So the idea is stories about animals. Well, it was maybe 8 or 10 years ago where their theme was pets. So to me, that's sort of the same theme. You can pull out a lot of that same stuff and go back to it.
Now, how can somebody get a hold of those books?
My website is real easy if you know how to spell my name, because my website is my name, jimkleefeld.com. And if even if you just Google Jim Kleefeld, you should be able to come across it. And I sell all of those theme show books and a few tricks and odds and ends and things. And Kid Show Matters, which every entertainer who works with children and family audiences ought to read.
Let's switch gears a little bit. You also do bizarre presentations for adults and some crazy things for teens, right?
I do. And actually, that was a business decision. I've been doing kids shows and family entertainment, summer library reading clubs for kids for, I think, maybe 35 years or so straight. I wasn't tired of them, but honestly, I kind of hit a wall because I had so many customers say, well, he's the guy to have. We have him all the time. But they didn't have me all the time. I had a librarian call me and say, it's been 2 or 3 years since you've been here, so we're going to have you back again because we always love your show. And then I looked at my database and it had been 9 years since I had been there. Because I was the guy everybody had. I was the guy that went to all the libraries. So every year they would say, oh, well, we can't have him again. I think we had him last year. Well, they didn't have me last year. They had me 4 years ago. So it got to that point where I was so popular that they weren't hiring me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. Yeah.
So I decided to go after a new market. I decided to put together a program for teens. If you look in your libraries, they want teens. They call them young adults in some libraries and teen groups in other libraries. They want them to come in. They want to entice them, but they don't know how. They don't know what to do. They don't have anything. The best they can come up with is let's have a manga drawing contest or maybe show Dragon Ball Z on a video or something. They don't know what to do. So I started offering programs for YAs, and I went with something I thought teens would like. Gory, murder, creepy, goth, bizarre stuff. I talked about Lizzie Borden axe murders, Titanic, and how horrible it is to drown at sea. Well, 14, 15-year-olds love that stuff. They just ate it.
Yeah, they do.
They just ate it up. So I booked a lot of those shows. The next year, I put together a steampunk show, and I was selling those, I think, 2 or 3 years, and all of a sudden, it occurred to me, the audience were half adults. They were coming to see the bizarre stuff, the Lizzie Borden, the gory stories and stuff, along with the teens. And then I started getting calls from librarians who said, could you do this like for just all adults? So it kind of segued into a whole other market. If you like kids and you want to do family entertainment, go for it. But if you want another market to add to it, offer an adult program. I have 5 adult programs now. 3 of them are ghost stories, haunted tales from your area, from around your town. I got a big story about the Mansfield Prison in Ohio. Everybody knows it. Half the people in the state have been there to visit. It's the setting for the Shawshank Redemption movie. It was filmed in that place. And it's haunted. It has ghosts. At least so they tell me. I've never seen any. So I have a big story about that in one of my programs. And I do adult magic and I do some mentalism, and it's really kind of aimed at adults. That's because it's another market. I can add that teen, YA, and adult market. Now I get 30 or 40 more shows than I have from just doing the kid shows.
Peter Bois does a spooky local magic show, and he talks about how after the magic show, people actually go to visit certain areas that he talks about in the magic show.
Yeah,
because people think that they're haunted.
Yeah, well, that's one of the keys that I found out. I localized it. I called my first show Ohio Spirits. It's about mm-hmm. ghosts and haunted places in Ohio, places you can drive to and visit. That localization is a key aspect. There are people I've talked with about this who have gone on and put together North Carolina ghosts, depending on where they live, telling stories about stuff that really happened. And every show, people are fascinated. I have people bring photographs. See this? That's a ghost. See that right there? See that shape? See that? I'm like, I'm not making out a face, but if you think that's a ghost, I'll believe you.
And of course, when they go to these places, who are they thinking about when they're going there?
Exactly.
Jim Kleefeld. Right. All right. We're going to switch gears once again. We're going to do fact or something John just made up. Sound like fun?
Sure.
Great.
Is it fact? Or is it something John just made up?
Here's what's going to happen. I'm going to say a headline and you're going to tell me whether it's true or not. And if it is true, tell me a little more about it.
Okay.
First headline. Jim once won a contest by creating 25 different Arabian tent illusions.
Yes, that is true.
That's true. 25 different Arabian tent illusions?
Yeah. The Arabian tent is a folding screen idea where, in case you're not familiar with it, you get a couple of big pieces of cardboard, half a box on each side, and put them on the stage. And then you move one, you move the next one, you take the third one and put it on top. So you kind of make a little cardboard playhouse out of it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a company called Creative Magic that was designing a way to make those out of collapsible wire and cloth framing, kind of like the car window shades.
Those were being made by Brian South.
Yeah, right. It was Brian and Rebecca. Brian South came up with those, the Bryce screens, and he put a bunch of stuff out like that.
By the way, not to interrupt you, but there's a terrific podcast, the Variety Artist Podcast with Brian South, and he talks about creating all of that stuff and how he finished the business and everything. It's fascinating.
Well, cool. I'm going to have to go listen to that. I hadn't seen that on the list.
It's wonderful.
Well, he had a contest, and he wanted somebody to come up with a design to put on the outside of this house, Arabian tent sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I decided to see how many I could come up with. So I designed and drew all the art for 25 different designs. And then I put costuming and wrote a script and put a little story how to do them. It basically, you're talking about a few pieces of fabric or cardboard that fold into a sort of house shape. Now, you could paint the whole thing red and it could be a doghouse. Or you could paint the whole thing to look like bricks and it could be a Wild West saloon. Or you could paint the whole thing to look like a circus tent and have clowns come out of it. That's what I came up with. 35 different sort of themed artwork. Wow. Here's what the picture looks like. Here's how to. I had one where the tent actually looked like a washing machine, and you put dirty laundry in the pile, and then out popped a lady dressed like Cinderella in rags.
So it's absolutely true.
Yes.
And we gave Brian South a little plug in the meantime.
Yes. Well, he's not doing that business anymore. He's a very clever guy, a very hard worker. So whatever he is doing is worth looking into.
Well, I'll tell you what he's doing only because I'm involved in it. He's doing something called Discover Magic. He was working with Michael Amar to create illusions for kids, and we're teaching magic to kids. Next headline, Jim owns the first magic set ever made in the United States.
I'm going to go with sort of true. It's pretty much true.
Yeah?
I think it is, but I can't prove that it is. In 1870, you understand this is 10 years after the Civil War. This is how early we're talking about here. In 1870, two brothers, Gus and Michael Hartz, came to America from Germany. And the first thing they did in New York was open a magic shop. It was the first magic shop in the United States of America. And it was in New York at 743 Broadway. And they put out a catalog and they sold stuff mostly to professional magicians, of which there were not a lot. And one of the things they sold was a magic set. And that magic set was a little wooden box with dividers and compartments in it. And it had 8 or 10 different tricks in it. Little cups and balls thing and a little seed barrel and a turned wood ball and vase and a handful of other little things, string trick, a trick with an egg. And they sold those for an outrageous sum of $5. Now,
okay. Back then, it was a lot of money, right?
In 1870, $5 was a lot of money. Today, that's probably about $150. Today, wow. Most people would not go into Costco and pay $150 for a toy magic set. Yeah. But that's what they were selling this for. And I came across one of those by accident. I bought it for way less than it was worth because I bought it blind, sight unseen, over the phone, after talking to a guy who'd gone through an auction in a barn in North Carolina and ended up with a box full of stuff that he didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody told him they thought it was magic stuff. He looked around and saw that I collected magic sets, and he called me and tried to describe it. Now, this is a guy who never done magic, never known anything about magic, and didn't have any idea what he was looking at. So he was trying to describe a magic set that was basically an 1870s magic set without knowing what it was. And I wasn't quite getting, I kept asking him, how old is it? And he kept saying, well, it's old. It's really old. Well, if you know anything about collecting and antiques, you know some people's old is 1950.
Yeah.
And some people's old is 1900. Well, I finally offered some money and he said, that sounds fine. And he sent it to me. And I got that. I opened up the box and inside the box on the inside of the front was a label that says Hartz Brothers 743 Broadway.
Wow.
They were only at that shop at 743 Broadway for 5 years, from 1870 to 1875. Then they closed it and moved to Chicago. So that dates that set roughly no later than 1875 and was probably one of the first magic sets sold in this United States. I've never seen anybody else that had one or knew of one or knew very much about it, but I do have the label and the history of the Hartz Brothers, and I'm pretty sure, even if it wasn't the first magic set they've ever sold, it's probably the earliest one that has survived.
Wow, that is amazing.
I put it in a glass cabinet because I have about 900 magic sets, and that's got a special place.
All right, next headline. Jim reads a book a week.
Okay, that's actually iffy. I probably do read at least a book a week.
Oh, I made that up.
But I can't be sure because I've spent so much of the COVID time writing that I haven't had a chance to read very much. I buy books all the time. I read mysteries. I read novels. I read magic books. I read history. I do read quite a bit.
Well, there's something we didn't know about you. There you go. All right, last one. Jim once drove 45 minutes to a show and realized when he got there that he had left his magic table full of props at home.
That is absolutely true.
I think that's happened to almost all of us who have done a lot of shows. So what did you do?
I have a big Leffler table and it's always in the vestibule by the garage door, and I always wheel it out, and then I back the car out and I open the trunk and I put it in the trunk and then I head on out. And this is during a time when I, and I'd have been like a week or two since I'd had a show, so it wasn't in the car. And if I'm in doing summer libraries, it's just in the trunk all summer long.
Yeah.
It just stays in the car. But I had taken it out. We'd done some family things. I put it in the vestibule, and then I realized I had to refill a couple of the consumable things. I went down the basement. I got some mouth coils or whatever it was I needed. I brought them up. I put them in the Leffler table. And for some reason, my wife stopped to talk to me. And I went and got in the car without putting the case in the car, without even ever realizing that I had the case in the car. And I drove 45 minutes and I got to the show and I'm just humming along. It's just fine. Everything's going great. Love this show. Been here a dozen times. Love the librarian. Kids are always good. I get out of the car. I pop the trunk. I look in the trunk and it's empty. Like, oh my God. Now, this was a long time ago, back before I had a cell phone, even. I'm thinking maybe 1980, 84, somewhere in there. I'm like, oh, my God, the show is like in 20 minutes. I don't use a lot of time to set up. I can get there 5 minutes before the show and start most of the times on time. But I don't. I get there 30 minutes early. So here I am 25, 30 minutes before the show. And I don't have the case. I rush in the library. I tell the librarian, oh my God, I don't know what to do. I drove here and I don't have my case and it's not here. And she said, well, is there any way you can get it here? I said, well, my wife is at home. She could bring it, but it would take her a while. She said, you know what? We were going to have a party and pizza and stuff after your magic show. We'll just do that first and we'll do the magic show when you're done.
Hooray.
I called my wife. She had already seen the case and somehow struggled to manage to get it into her trunk of her car and was sitting there by the phone with her keys in her hand, hoping I would call.
Oh, that's nice.
And I called her and she said, how far did you get? And I said, all the way.
Oh,
I said, I'll meet you at the McDonald's on East 30th Street. So I drove about 20 minutes in her direction. She drove about 25 minutes in my direction. We transferred the case from her car to my car. I drove back and they were just finishing up their pizza stuff and making some hand puppets when I rushed in and started to set everything up. If the librarian had not been so gracious and prepared to do 25, 30 minutes worth of other stuff, it could have been bad, but she was fine with it.
Oh, thank goodness.
That was fact. Or something John just made up.
All right, we're going to go on to some fan questions. You want a couple fan questions?
I sure do. Wait, is this all from the same fan? Because I know I had one. I wasn't sure about any more.
There was just two fans. Actually, one question you already answered, but we're going to ask it anyway and see where you go with it. The first one is from Cecil Lewis. He's an excellent corporate magician out of Idaho. He asks, what is your favorite routine and why?
Well, I guess I have a couple. Because I do a new show every year, I tend to change the routines every year. But I spent many, many years doing strolling magic. I worked a lot of festivals, a lot of outdoor work, which is just walk around and, you know, sort of meet and greet stuff. My favorite routine, I think, came out of that period. I call it the rope inspector. It's basically a vanishing knot that is a 5, 6, 7 minute routine.
Wow.
I like it because I have done it so many times over and over and over that I have changed it and honed it and fixed the timing and adjusted the pauses. I know where to look. I know when not to look. It just flows perfectly well every single time.
Well, and the beautiful thing about that is the entire list of props is a rope.
A rope.
Not, that's it.
Doesn't cut, doesn't get shorter, doesn't have to be replaced. I've been using the same piece of rope for 15 years.
Oh, nice. All right. Last fan question. Claude Haggerty, the super sponsor man, who has a terrific interview, by the way, on episode 80 on the Variety Artist Podcast. He asked, how has COVID impacted your business? And my follow-up question to that is, how have you changed your business to deal with that?
I haven't. Sad to say, I adore Robert Bex and what he's done going into Zoom and virtual shows. I know a handful of other people. Scott's done a lot of stuff. Tim Sonnefeld started a foam party business. It was sort of out of his wheelhouse, but he jumped right in. I have done none of those. For two reasons. First of all, as I said, this was my 49th consecutive year of doing library shows. Next year will be my 50th year, and I hope that we are all back again. I'm patient enough to wait for that. I don't do birthday parties. I don't depend on every last show for groceries on the table. So I figured I could live for 10 or 12 months without shows. I didn't try to go out virtual shows. I filmed three programs, one Halloween show, one summer fantasy show, and one adult Tales from Beyond show. They are all posted on YouTube, but marked as private. I have sent out some solicitations, sold those shows to a handful of clients. And when somebody, mostly libraries, pays me for the show, I go onto YouTube and I unlock it and I send them the URL, and then they have a week to watch it, and then I lock it up again. So that was sort of my only real response to COVID. That, and I sat down and wrote a book, a big book, very comprehensive book. It's for magicians and mentalists. It is a virtual encyclopedia of book tests. Anything and everything you wanted to know about doing book tests, and listing all of the ones I could find in commercial products, books, and magazines. It took me literally every single day for 6 or 7 months to put that much material down and write that much. It is 99.9% finished. I'm just looking for a way to get it published and distributed right now. So it will be out soon, but that's what I did with my time.
So when that comes out, you're going to have to send me a message and I will put it on my Facebook group, so that way, at least they'll be able to see, hey, it's done. Here it is. Because I'd love to get a hold of that myself.
To do that.
Terrific. Well, thank you, Jim, for doing my show. That was fun.
You are quite welcome, John. I had a fun time. That was great.
Do you have some sort of social media or websites or things you want to promote before I let you go?
JimKleefeld.com. I answer emails all the time. I just put my phone on the dresser and I don't really look at Twitter or Facebook very much at all. So
JimKleefeld.com is the way to go.
Yeah.
Just jump in there. If you haven't already, make sure to join the Variety Arts Community Facebook group, where you can ask questions of our guests, and I'll do my best to ask on the interview. There's Free for All Fridays, where you can promote yourself any way you like, and Marketing Monday. The first Monday of every month, you can post your toughest marketing challenges, and someone there will answer. All sorts of cool things. Check it out. And thanks to all my Variety artists. Tell all your friends about the Variety Artist Podcast. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
You bet.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist, but your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.